Hello, everybody, and welcome to the DieCast. My name is Rootsgar, and with me are Josh.
Yes, multiple Josh, in fact.
Seamus.
Hi there.
Non-multiple Josh.
I am singular Josh.
Chris.
Hello.
And the Josh who has no voice.
Fuck, damn it.
That's my favorite Josh.
Yeah, can we fire the other two Joshes? I think we've got redundant Joshery.
The Josh Council has convened and has decided that our response to that will be fuck you.
Well, the Josh Council is usually pretty firm on its rulings, so let's just go on to the first topic. Fallout 4, how hype are we?
Yeah. Oh, it's a Bethesda game. Okay.
You want to know how stupid I am? I keep watching these trailers and like sifting through them, looking for some hint that there'll be some Fallout 1-ish type, like, dark humor in there. And of course, it is just, it's like, imagine Saints Row, but the jokes aren't funny. It's just a cartoon world, and yet, I still just can't let it go. I just can't let it go. I just want that Fallout again, Fallout 1 again. So yeah. I'm probably destined for disappointment, is I guess the TLDR of where I'm at.
See, I mean, I jest about it being a Bethesda game, but like some part of me still likes Bethesda games for what they are. Like it's gonna have a terribly written story. You know, the characters are not gonna make any sense. It's not gonna be at all like Fallout 1. And these are all things that I've come to accept and expect, and if, you know, any of them are subverted in any fashion, then I'll be happier.
Bethesda has a great track record of being good at the shit Bethesda cares about. It's just that I am afraid that without the shit I care about, which is present in games like New Vegas, you know, it can be done, then the game's gonna feel kind of hollow. And I am definitely feeling kind of lonely. And I don't mean that particularly, like, I don't mean that in, like, a whiny way. Like, oh, all these fucking plebs excited for this sick-ass AAA video game. They're probably gonna have fun. What's up with that? I just mean, like, you know, it sort of sucks that I'm probably going to have to explain it if I'm not excited to a lot of people I know, actually. And, you know, I don't know. I've actually been trying to keep as little of the marketing in my feeding trough as possible, and I think that will probably have a good net effect. I will say that things I have heard, I'm really, really trying not to immediately assume it's going to make things terrible, but the things I have heard are not exceptionally promising. The dialogue wheel, for example.
Yeah, that system. Oh, that brings up an interesting anecdote.
For those unfamiliar with this, including me, what is the dialogue wheel? Are we talking like an Oblivion style, you have to...
Yeah, it's like you get a pie that appears, and there's as many as four choices, which are each two words long, or shorter, or long, maybe like three words long.
So, we're talking more Mass Effect-y.
Yeah, this is Mass Effect-y.
You'll select something that says, I'm not working with Cerberus, and then your character will say, I'm only working with Cerberus because they're awesome.
Yeah, I'm not looking forward to that.
Cerberus number one fan.
If the dialogue sucks, I want to know beforehand that it's going to suck, and I want to choose the shittiest piece of dialogue from the shitty dialogue.
I thought they were, like, full sentences.
No. They're complete sentences, but they're short. They're like, no thanks, or... Like the ones for dog meat were like, you're a mutt is one of them or something. Like, you're a mutt, really?
So that would be the Captain Obvious dialogue choice.
Maybe that's good. Maybe that's just... I mean, if that's all the more choices they want to give you, then putting as few words... Just to play devil's advocate here... Putting as few words into your mouth as possible might be a good thing.
Then you say that your character's voiced. Then you speak.
Yeah, it's straight up like Human Revolution, Mass Effect, Witcher 3 style. Like, your character is going to have a voice.
I knew that from the E3 demo, but I... But I don't know, the way Rutskarn described it, I was like, oh, maybe they're only going to give you three or four words to say at a time, and that wouldn't be so bad. Because then you can, like, sort of imagine your own reasoning for things, you know. But if your character is going to choose to do something and state all their reasons for doing it, then that's really frustrating.
I think, like, having a fully voiced protagonist works fine in some situations, but it works a lot better when you're playing a character that's already established in universe rather than just creating your own out of whole cloth. Like, when you're playing Geralt and he starts to pontificate, you're like, okay, Geralt has his own ideas about the world that maybe I don't necessarily share, and I'm just kind of steering him around.
Right.
Or Adam Jensen, you know, in a similar fashion, versus, like, Commander Shepard, which can be basically anyone, but...
Whoever played Skyrim and said, boy, I wish the Dragonborn talked out loud. I would love that.
Yeah. I see, the thing is, so one thing that I feel is missing from a lot of Bethesda games is the choice of dialogue options that give your character a different voice. Like, I felt even New Vegas had this more, where you could choose dialogue options that made you sound like, oh, I'm a smart guy, or oh, I'm a stuffy guy, or yep. Oh, I'm a snarky guy. And yeah, Bethesda, it's kind of like, you're a laid-back, Joss Whedon-ish dude who is sometimes evil and sometimes, like, kind of bland and good. And I don't know. I don't know why I'm assuming that this is going to be terrible, because there's no particular reason to do so. You could make a perfectly good, fun game with this. It's just not matching up to the picture of the game I want in my head. And I'm really going to have to wrestle with that while I'm playing it.
Their dialogue has always been horrendous. Why are you voicing? Like, you should play up the stuff you're good at and downplay the stuff you are just horrible at. And here they're just taking the stuff they're horrible at and just making it front and center. And that just is and it's gonna, like, hurt the ability to mod and have less player choice and just, you know, and, like, you're just gonna want to click through it. Like, who wants to hear what my stupid character has to say?
I really feel like I'm going to have to sort of go in with the idea that I'm not really playing my character. That I'm getting the ability to customize their character. That's kind of how I'm going to have to think about it. And to not,
but it's
a
Bethesda game, and it's like, I mean, Bethesda games are strongest when you go off the main quest and just wander around and do stuff. So, it works against the strengths of the studio.
Like, I don't know if I fucking care all that much, because I've played a bunch of Bethesda games, and I never really once got the sense that I was playing a character that I created so much as that I was just playing Bethesda man or woman.
Bethesda man, I love this. This is now canon.
And, you know, I couldn't escape their boneheaded dialogue anyway.
You're
Hello,
right.
My name
You're...
is Bethesda, and this is my favorite main quest in Cyrodiil.
Please tell me where my father is. I miss him so much. By the way, you're awesome,
Three
Dog.
Can you really tell me that, like, you were so much more immersed in Skyrim and Oblivion and Fallout 3 than you would be in a Fallout game where you have a voice-acted dialogue? I mean, like, I look at this with sort of a...
Actually, I actually would, just because it's faster to get through the dialogue if I don't have to listen to the me voice. I don't care what I say if my dialogue is dumb.
I guess. I look at this as... I'm kind of looking at this with morbid curiosity. Like, maybe this will convince them to fucking write decent dialogue for the main character. Because when you voice dialogue and it's bad, it's very obvious that it's bad in ways that, like, if you just write it, you might not necessarily pick up on.
The other thing is that, like, okay... So, the Fallout universe has sort of established that people from, like, different backgrounds have different modes of talking. That there does still exist, like, some African American vernacular English and stuff. It is going to feel a little bit weird that that won't be a thing at all, I'm guessing. Unless they have multiple, like, voice actors for the main character, which I don't think is likely.
No, no way. You're going to sound like Nathan Drake voice or whoever.
Listen, if they just announced tomorrow that the dude who voiced Lee Everett was going to do all of your dialogue, I wouldn't fucking care. I wouldn't even care that it was a Fallout game. I'd be like, yeah, sign me up for that.
Yeah, Dave Fennoy.
I would go through a conversation, and then I would load my save, and I would go through it again just so I could hear him say every single word that was written for him for that conversation.
But it's definitely a white guy. Like, it's definitely the genericest white guy voice you've ever heard. It's not a big guy. He's not like talking like a big football player. He has no personality. Just this really neutral guy.
Hello, fellow Vault members. How are you doing today?
Yeah. I mean, at least it's not Mark Meer.
Yeah, there's just going to be this moment where, like, a super mutant stumbles out of a closet wearing a party hat and just throwing poop at the walls, and your character's going to be like, okay. Well, that's random.
And the female voice actor is Juhani.
Okay. I guess I'm playing a female
Courtney
character.
Taylor.
I've already decided to play female. What, Chris?
No, I was just saying that the real problem isn't that I don't know. You guys have said everything. Never mind. Ignore me.
No! Come on. You talk once every 5 minutes. Come on.
I lost my train of thought.
Damn it. I blame you, Josh.
I mean, you should, but I'm not.
Well,
really
find it. You have 30 seconds.
I don't know. I basically, it's not Bethesda's wheelhouse, but the other problem is that they seem to be focusing on combat so much anyway that I don't know why they did this. Like, every bit of the trailer has been power armor and machine guns and nukes and you can tell a dog where to go. I have very little faith that there is... Like, they do seem to be embracing the whole, you know, traditional Bethesda, go on any adventure you want, make the Fallout world your own, which does give me a little bit of pause, because it means that I'm worried the Wasteland might feel a little too Ubisoft-y.
Ooh.
Like, I'm a little worried that in an attempt to take this, what is frankly a kind of a quirky franchise. I mean, if you step back and look at it, it's a computer RPG built around Mad Max and a boy and his dog. Like, it is kind of an obscure, weird thing. And for it to be this big AAA game is kind of bizarre. And I am worried that they're going to try to boil it down to a series of go wherever you want, do whatever you want, theme park, whatever, and just sort of make it a big vat o' content rather than having any story. Because at least, even in Fallout 3, there was like that narrative thread. And obviously New Vegas had a much better narrative thread. I do not get the impression...
Well, I mean, Fallout 3 was very narrative heavy, I think. Yeah.
Yeah,
Fallout,
I mean, it's...
I wouldn't call it not a narrative game.
Weirdly narrative heavily for a Bethesda game, actually.
It was bad. Like, it was a bad narrative, but was there. And I'm a little worried that they're going to do a sort of, like, try to do what New Vegas did, but not as good. I.e. sort of set you off in an open world with an overall quest, but instead of facilitating role-playing and smaller stories that happen in the bylines and sidelines, it's going to be sort of a really loose narrative to minimize having to write this guy's dialogue and encourage player expression. And I don't know if that will lend itself to not being something like a giant version of Watch Dogs in the post-apocalypse.
It's not going to be as bad as Watch Dogs because it's not going to be an Ubisoft open world.
Yeah, you know what? Bethesda are competent. Let's never suggest otherwise. They're bad at some things, but Bethesda are good at their jobs.
You know what? I'm going to admit something that's going to cause a bunch of hate, but I actually liked the gameplay of Fallout 3 better than New Vegas.
I can get behind that. I don't really have a problem with that. In fact, I think Fallout 3 was stronger in every way, except it was so relentlessly, unapologetically dumb. And that's kind of always the problem we have is like, well, why can't we get this game but paired with something just way smarter? This stupidity is not a required component for this game to work.
Yeah. Fallout 3 was by far the most hands-off, you can get all of this powerful, ridiculous shit and totally break this combat engine if you really want to, Bethesda game. And something that irked me about Skyrim was how restrictive it was in that fashion, which is what eventually led me to doing the alchemy, like, singularity loop bug in the spoiler warning season that we did on it, because I needed something to get way ahead of the curve, and that was it. But, like, in Fallout 3, I mean, there's just so many things that you can just, like, you can just totally destroy that game's difficulty if you want to, and I kind of appreciated that. And New Vegas made that a lot harder. It made it, like, a lot more like, oh, you have to actually play fair. And coming from Fallout 3 to New Vegas, that kind of irked me.
Because that was, like, one of the things is, you don't want every game to have the same exploits, but finding and building a character around those exploits is kind of fun and interesting. And gives you a replacement for the main quest that isn't worth.
Right. I mean, New Vegas did have the ballistic fist, and that was a huge barrel of fun, but it just didn't quite match Infinite Pip-Boy suit, or Infinite Stealth Boy suit, and all of the shenanigans that created.
But if somebody says they prefer Fallout 3, I can totally get behind that, the atmosphere being better. You know, just, it feels more post-apocalyptic to be in ruined buildings.
I mean,
than
it's
to be...
the wrong atmosphere for the particular setting and story, yeah. But, you know, it worked.
Right.
I wouldn't mind a Fallout game about just crawling around DC sewer tunnels.
Exactly. Yeah, if the sort of environments and the gameplay had been in the same universe as the story, that would have been super favorite game. So there's a lot to like. You know, I know I rag on Fallout 3 all the time, but it's, you know, I played it more than I played New Vegas. Because, you know, once you're done with the main quest, all you've got left is the gameplay. And I think Fallout 3 had it better.
Yeah,
it at least had more things to explore.
I think that's what it comes down to. I really have to check myself from getting too pessimistic. And I think that we all sort of need, you know, I knew that when we started talking about this was going to kind of turn into a bummer cast. So let's try to end on that positive note, which is, you know, there's probably a lot to really look forward to from this. And I actually don't think it's going to, I don't have share Chris's fears for what it might turn into. Mostly because, firstly, that's not Bethesda's brand. And secondly, you know, Obsidian's press Blitz was pretty much exactly the same thing. Just pictures of things blowing up. And yeah, that turned out to have
That's a really good point. Oh, yeah, New Vegas looked stupid as hell in trailers. It looked like it had nothing interesting to say. And then you get into the game and it was different.
Pretty much instantly interesting.
Yeah.
Now, can I actually say I was really surprised by New Vegas. I didn't even like Obsidian when I played New Vegas. Like, I had never played an Obsidian game I liked up to that point. And, like, you know, I was sort of holding off, like, this is just, you know, it's more of the same. I just went off on Fallout 3. I saw somebody playing it, and basically I said the same thing I said when I clicked pre-order on Fallout 4, which was, fuck it. And I got to the first town, and I'm like, wow, this is really surprising. I think the moment I knew that I was onto something was when they were talking about the Legion, and they mentioned the fact that the Legion are after resources, like after electricity. That's like something
It's world building. It's world building. They thought about, where does electricity come from? Where does food come from? Oh, look, people fight over those resources, and so everything feels connected. And you can, you know, you feel like you tug on a thread over here, and it affects things over there, even though it probably usually doesn't. But it's world building. It's why I loved...
It wasn't even a sexy resource. Like, you know, Fallout 3 in theory has water, but, like, which doesn't make sense for a lot of reasons. But, you know, water has, like, a very strong thematic element, and that's clearly why they chose it. You know, Obsidian chose electricity because it was logical, because it was practical and made sense. Not because it was particularly... Not because of the Hoover Dam stirs anything in the American imagination besides, oh, yeah, social studies.
Exactly. But yeah, you can, it's just wonderful world building. And that's what I loved about it, is you go talk to all the different factions and they've all got different views. They don't all just talk about, boy, super mutants sure are big and scary, aren't they? They've got interesting things and different views on themselves and each other. And it makes the world feel so much bigger than the square mile that they give you. It's world building. It's why I love Mass Effect 1. It's why I love New Vegas, even though they've got other problems.
So, does anybody fucking care about that dog, though?
Oh, I so don't care about the dog.
I'm, like, hoping that's just, a marketing thing, because I really don't fucking care about dog meat.
I don't want to have to take the dog with me. Please don't tell me the dog is mandatory. I hate having companions with me.
I believe you have to run into the dog, but after that, you can just leave the dog, and it will follow at its own pace.
It's a Bethesda game. You can probably just shoot the dog.
I don't want
to
do that.
Yeah, you can shoot the dog, and then it'll get up a second later.
I mean, it's a companion. It has to be able to get killed. That's the Bethesda rules. Them's the rules.
But I don't think I could bring it to... I don't think I could bring myself to kill the dog. But I just don't want to have to take it with me when I go into a vault and go to shoot super mutants. I don't want this... I don't want a bitey animal running out in front of my friggin' flamethrower. I just... No.
Let's put it wrong. Like this. You don't want a Bethesda companion.
Yeah.
A mandatory Bethesda companion that you can't even talk to.
Ugh. Actually, that might be a plus.
Well, actually, so much for ending on a positive note. Holy shit. Yeah. I dropped Thanks, the ball. Josh. On that one. let's move on to a more pleasant subject. Chris, you recently took a tour of spook houses. Houses that are scary that they have in Florida. That in one place, which also has roller coasters.
All you really have to say is houses in Florida. The spook is just sort of implied.
Was it spooky or spoopy?
A little bit of both. I had a good time. I don't know. I don't know how much you guys want me to prattle on about Halloween Horror Nights and houses and scary things.
I am delighted.
Go crazy.
We asked you just so we can make fun of you.
No, I kind of halfway want to write a thing up about haunted houses and their design, because I really, really, really love them. First of all, there's something like inherently playful about going to a place like this, about going and trying to get afraid, trying to get scared, because it becomes a game, right? Like, it is itself kind of its own little game with a winner and loser, depending on whether they scare you or not. And so every encounter basically becomes...
Do you poop?
In general, or when they scare me?
No, I was suggesting that was the fail state. Mission failed, britches soiled.
That did not happen.
They make everybody put on diapers before they're allowed to go into the house.
No, but it's fun because it's really... Part of it's kind of like a game because there's a winner and a loser, and part of it's kind of like a magic trick because a lot of it is about designing a distraction. It's almost a sort of a type of sleight of hand, except sleight of hand implies like dexterity and skill. It's basically knowing how to deceive people by setting up one thing that you want to look at and coming at you from a completely different angle, but then getting into that headspace of, okay, so you know that you're supposed to be looking over there, so you're going to look over here, so we got to figure out how to make you think that we're not going to come from there. And it's sort of a, I don't know, a game of poker. It's really, really fun how they can do it. And I don't want to get into some of the designs, but there's sort of specific patterns that get used over and over again in these houses, but then you can combine them and remix them into really interesting sort of setups.
Can you give us one, for instance?
The easy example would be, you know, you have something the audience member is supposed to look at, a big spooky dead body or even just a scene. One of them was an electric chair where it would go off every couple of minutes and it would flash a strobe light and there would be electricity and you go, oh, wow, it's a electric chair, it's spooky. But while you're looking at that, people come in from the sides and up behind you and actually try to scare you. And so that's just a real basic how you get people looking at that. But eventually that becomes really obvious, right? Like you put a big shiny in the middle of the room and you go, oh, that's okay, don't look at that. Look at the walls. Where are they coming in through the windows? So what they have to do is design rooms that sort of subvert that, either by turning the centerpiece of the room into the scary thing, or by presenting you with rooms where you see the centerpiece, you see where you think they're going to come from, and they come from somewhere completely different. And so there are things like, they have things like drop away walls, but walls that when lit from behind are see-through. So you might look and, you know, there might be a dead body on the floor or something in the room and you go, oh, that's where the bad guy is. So, and then you look to your left and there's a window and you're like, okay, that's where he's coming from. So you're looking at the window going, I got this house. I got this room. I know where they're coming from. And then they drop the wall behind you with a strobe light and the strobe light highlights a guy that's actually right behind you the whole time, even though you thought you were safe because you were up against a wall. So the idea is to basically use practical effects and you know, magician-y stuff. I saw mirrors used, fog effects were used. It's basically mixing game design and magic and to make people scared. And it's a lot of fun for me.
Now, what I was going to ask is, how did you actually get into haunted houses? Because, you know, you have a reputation for kind of being the lightweight in terms of spoop games, but that might just be you having more experience, like, opening up vulnerability to this kind of material? How would you answer that?
Maybe. There is something vaguely consensual about it, right? Like Josh, for example, refuses to consent to being scared, and so it is very difficult to scare him. Not because Josh is particularly brave, but because he just sort of turns it all into a series of comedy jokes. He doesn't, like, want to be scared, so it's not scary. You do have to sort of give yourself over into getting scared, generally speaking, to make it fun. Because if it's not consensual, I was thinking about this. Like, if you're not really feeling it, it's not a fun scared. It is a really, really scared. Like, panic scared. And that's not fun. That's scary. And yeah, you really have to sort of put your mind into it. Anyway, how I got into it was, I moved to Florida when I was 13. At some point, and we ended up going to Halloween Horror Nights just because it's primarily a local event. Like, a lot of people fly in to do it, but it is primarily a local event. It's during the off season in the middle of October. And what they've done is basically Disney ends up taking all the little kids and families with Mickey's Not So Scary, which is, you know, a big sort of kid friendly, give out candy, change the lighting in the park slightly and have a slightly spoopy villain parade. And then that's Mickey's Not So Scary. All the little kids and all the families go to that. And then Universal has Halloween Horror Nights, which is the more adult, and I use that term loosely, event where there's actual blood and gore and people with chainsaws trying to scare you and custom alcoholic drinks and the whole nine yards and all the 13 to 30 year olds end up going to that. And so when I was a teenager in Florida, that's obviously where I wanted to go, and it was fun and I kind of got addicted to it.
Cool. I mean, I've actually, it's interesting that you say this, Chris, because I've sort of been adjacent to this issue in that I've actually run horror gaming sessions, like horror tabletop sessions. And, you know, I certainly have experienced the, you know, the players need to be in the right mindset aspect, but, like, it's actually kind of interesting to try to use the misdirection you've talked about when you don't have, you have limited, I should say, physical props.
Oh, yeah, I imagine on a tabletop game it has to be way more cerebral. A lot of what happens in these houses is sort of immediate, you know, a gut reaction, loud noise plays, lights flash, and if they're coming at you from the right angle and you don't see it coming, it just sort of impulsively scares you. Trying to get that kind of reaction out of a tabletop game has got to be really difficult.
I actually did manage to do that once. How it happened, I used misdirection and a physical thing to get an effect. And what it was basically they were supposed to rendezvous at a tower. And they get to the tower and they think they're going to be betrayed when they get here, but they go in, it's in the middle of the city, and they find dead bodies. They find everyone that was probably supposed to kill them murdered, like slashed, hacked apart, and, you know, leading all the way up the spiral staircase to the top. And at the top, there's like a table that has a bunch of straps on it, and stuck through one of the straps is like a wrist and a giant clawed hand. And what they don't know yet is that this is a dead troll, or that this were a, was where a dead troll was until it was brought back to life. And, like, the hand was what it tore off to escape the bonds. So the hand is still alive, but they don't know that yet. So I'm sort of like, they're investigating the room, like, investigating the scrolls, and they ask about the hand, and I'm like, well, okay, here we go. And so what I do is I'm like, all right, so here's how the hand's configured, and I, like, hold it out, and I, like, cut my other hand over it, like a cuff. And I'm like, yeah, all right, so it's resting like this. And you actually notice that there's, and I'm sort of, like, distract them to my voice. And then at some point, I suddenly just, like, lunge the hand within the cuff at them. And I actually kind of should not have done that because they fell off of their chairs. And they didn't want to talk to me after that game. So if you're a DM and an asshole, there's an asshole DM tip for you.
But watching people get scared is part of the fun, right? I mean, why else would you be playing a spoopy horror game?
So the thing about that game was it wasn't super supposed to be scary. It was like that campaign was sort of like it might get spooky from time to time. But I don't really signpost this is the horror session. And yeah, that's part of it, is that they weren't prepared for it. Although, actually, I think if they were prepared for it, that it would probably have been a little more tense. The result would have been a little more pronounced. I might try to do before Halloween, like, a guide to running horror games, because I've had some success with that. And that's, I think, easily the hardest kind of tabletop gaming to do. We actually have time for a mailbag this week.
Oh, hang on, guys. I gotta get going. I'll see you later.
Okay, dear Josh, what is up with you? What are you, like, seriously, are you some kind of failed Russian experiment? I think we could field this one. Okay, what's a good one? All right, let's go with this one. Dear DieCast, Nintendo recently filed a patent for a game console without a disk drive. While that certainly isn't the same as officially announcing such a console, it still seems like big news. Thoughts? Best wishes, Jared.
Why would you have to file a patent for... what does that mean, a patent for a console without a disk drive? It's like, well, wait, we already had those 15 years ago. That's not a new invention. That's leaving parts of your console out. So I wonder what the actual patent is. And I'm not going to try and read this article while we're doing a diecast.
A stationary game apparatus comprising an internal hard disk drive storing a program and or data, a communications unit transmitting slash receiving a program and or data via a network, and a processor executing a program stored in the hard disk to perform game processing, wherein the apparatus is not provided with an optical disk drive.
Did they just make an Ouya?
I don't know.
Is that what they did?
Fancy one, Ouya. Yeah.
Fancy Ouya. Oh, well, be still my heart.
Hardware analysis aside, the idea of a console without a disk drive from Nintendo is really, 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 really not so interesting to not interesting. That's not appealing. Nintendo's biggest problem has never been their hardware. It has always been their entirely lackluster online support. I mean, I don't know if you have tried to upgrade your or if you remember us discussing the going to from a 3DS to a new 3DS and how you have to either use a PC as an intermediary or use a physical wire. But, like, I'm horrified. Yeah. I'm going to someday drop my DS in a toilet or something, and everything I've ever bought on that system, you know, an entire generation's worth of hardware or games, is just going to go away because I dropped the machine in the toilet. Nintendo doesn't really care to transfer licenses to anything other than the hardware you have. So stuff like that is what Nintendo needs to work on.
What's interesting about the announcement is how this plays to literally none of Nintendo's strengths.
Saying that Nintendo's problem has never been its hardware is a bit disingenuous, though. I mean, the fact that they've been in this sort of weird, like, halfway next-gen cycle for the past couple of generations, and their consoles are not powerful enough to handle the same sort of things that Sony and Microsoft's consoles can, is a major, huge reason why they lack a lot of third-party support, and therefore why particularly the Wii U is suffering significantly, because nobody wants to redo all of their game assets to port it to the Wii U.
when nobody owns a Wii U and wants to play it anyway.
It's a chicken and egg thing, I think. I think they don't have games, so they're not selling units, so they don't have any games. I don't think it's just that the hardware is not there. It's that the hardware is not there, and then the install base is a paltry percentage of what it is on the other two consoles, so why even bother doing any of that effort? Because if there was a sizable audience, I mean, the Wii had a fair number of ports from the Xbox and Xbox 360 and PS3. It's not unheard of that you could do that. But the Wii also had an install base of millions. The Wii U does not so much.
Well, yeah, and even with the Wii, it wasn't as ubiquitous. It was like, you know, it was multi-platform even at that time meant PS4 or PS3, Xbox 360, and sometimes PC. Was what a multi-platform game was. And if you had a Wii port, it would come out like 6 months later and it wouldn't really resemble the other games and, you know, you kind of rolling the dice on whether or not it would actually be any good.
Now, could this not actually be a Wii U without a disk drive? Is that possible?
Does the Wii U store have the infrastructure to even handle not having an optical drive?
What does the Wii U have and doesn't it have? It came out 3 years ago and I feel like it's been in the media's attention for approximately 45 seconds.
So I have a Wii U, and I can tell you some of those things. It shipped with a digital store, so yay, you can actually buy things digitally. It still has all the same account baggage that the DS has, so boo on that. And it also shipped with, I believe the big one was 10, but that was the limited edition black one. Everything else shipped with 2 gigabytes, which was not enough for most Nintendo games. So I have to buy an external hard drive just to be able to download this stuff. So this is a company that shipped machines with 2 gigabyte hard drives in an era where that was already too small.
That is small.
Thumb drives are these days often bigger than that. So yeah, it is comedically small.
Bigger than that.
so yeah, it was basically enough space to run the operating system and maybe get some WiiWare updates and maybe a emulated game or two.
The thing comes rolling off the assembly line and they're like, okay, there's enough room for all the updates and the operating system itself and for the Wii store. And then somebody goes, but what if they want to install a game? And everybody just stops and stares at the machine in stony silence for 5 minutes.
Aside, I don't know what they do to their emulated titles or how much of it is just DRM or, you know, encryption and obfuscating what the actual ROM data is. But when you download an emulated virtual machine game from the Wii U store, even something like Super Mario Brothers is 100 or 200 megabytes. Like, I don't know what they do to it, but they bloat the bejesus out of it. So that's another reason why I just... Nothing about Nintendo owning an online digital distribution store feels like a responsible move to me, given the company's policies regarding online stuff, given their history with hard drive sizes, interests in file size compression, the ability to re-download your stuff if your machine breaks, keying all this stuff to your account. I love Nintendo. I have a lot of their games, but they are just notoriously bad on this front. And so having a game console that is built on that gives me pause. I would like to see, more than cool games, I would like to see them address that stuff first.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think any of us are really in disagreement that digital is probably the future. I mean, it's already happened for the PC, and we're all PC gamers, so we all kind of have that baggage when we're talking about it, but it seems like something that's just going to happen. It's
meanwhile,
Seamus
pulls out his A-track and is like, wait, what?
You know, I mean, the future is digital on the PC, but that's only because you can't. I would still be driving to the store and buying boxes if they had games in boxes at the store, but I'm 1,000 years old, so just ignore me.
But for Nintendo to do this, they definitely have to fix a lot of their, you know, they have to actually finally commit to getting with it and doing an online service that is not 10 years old on launch or older.
So let's move on to our next question here. Dear Diecast, limited ammunition is one of the most common mechanics in video games, but it's never seemed that interesting to me. It's only ever used to gate off certain weapons from use by not providing ammo for them, or to provide tension when the player has very little ammo left, but if you ever run out of all your ammo, then you just can't play anymore. Ammo seems to be at most just a hindrance to having fun. My question is, are there any games that make ammo fun? If not, is there a way to make ammo a fun mechanic, or should ammo go the way of health in modern shooters and just regenerate over time? I immediately have an answer for this. Receiver. I have been playing a shitload of Receiver. It's, in Receiver, your how many bullets you have means how can I deal with turrets? If I have, it very much changes your tactics. If I have 10 bullets, I'll take a shot at it at long range. If I have, like, 6 extra bullets, I'll, you know, wait until I'm close and then take a shot. And, you know, risk getting hit by that or blindsided by another turret. If I have 2 bullets, I'll see if I can slip by it. And if I have no bullets, I'm screwed and I have to find a different way to go. And it works because if you do run out of ammo and you just die, which, you know, can happen, then it's the game is based around sort of short play sets. So, in Receiver, ammo actually really informs strategy in a way that doesn't have that grinding fail state you talked about. Or rather, it does, but it doesn't matter. Also, there's no name for this question, so I don't know who to credit.
I don't either.
Thank you, whoever wrote this question.
Well, you know, they
don't
did
worry,
something
it's probably
really...
Seamus's fault.
They did something really smart in the Mass Effect game, which is that they made... Oh, wait, they got rid of that idea, and now guns need bullets. Never mind.
I mean, interesting to note that Battlefront doesn't have... The new Battlefront game does not have ammo.
I mean, really, that's what I was going to say, is that it comes down to how interested you are in balancing ammo as a resource. Like, how interested are you in minute-to-minute resource management? And in some, and like what Rutskarn was saying, in games where resource management matters a lot, Receiver or even something like System Shock 2, where, you know, what type of ammunition you have and how much of it you have can totally change who you choose to engage with and why. I think that really makes ammo interesting as a resource to balance. And do I want to spend the armor piercing rounds to kill the guy? I could probably get around, but if I'm going to be rooting around in there in the dark, I probably want to take him out before, you know, that, then it becomes an interesting strategic decision. In games like Quake, a lot of that becomes legacy stuff to just encourage you to use different weapons. Something like Quake or Doom were really like you would get to the level where almost all the ammo is shotgun pellets and rockets, and you're like, oh, well, that's the weapon the level designers want me to use to engage with these monsters. So it sort of forces the player. It's less about resource management, more forcing the player to conform to a specific play style.
It's about resource management, more about player management.
Exactly.
The other thing it does is it gives them a way to give you really powerful weapons that don't immediately make all previous weapons completely useless. Like the super nail gun is awesome, but oh, it uses so much ammo, I can't just go around and use it all the time. But I can still have the visceral thrill of using it once in a while. If I could use it all the time, then, oh, never pull out the shotgun again. But, you know, because it's precious, I get to choose when I want that thrill of using one of my good guns.
That was one of the more clever design decisions in Doom, I think, where, like, you know, you can use the BFG, but then you're limiting your use of the other most powerful weapon, which is the plasma cannon.
Hmm. Oh, I never thought about that.
So I don't know if there's a way to, like, make ammo fun. I mean, active reload, maybe, from Gears of War, but
oh,
ammo
fuck,
itself is not
reload.
Fun, but... Battlefront has active reload, actually. Speaking of Battlefront, the new Battlefront game has active reload. There's no bullets, but you have a heat sink, and when your heat is overflowing and you're essentially, quote-unquote, out of ammo as it cools, you'll have a gauge that slowly decreases, and if you tap reload right at the right time... It's not reload, it's empty cool sink or what, heat sink or whatever. But if you do it at the right time, you get a really fast reload instead of the slow one. But if you screw it up, your guy touches the heat sink and he goes, ow! And he like wiggles his hand and it takes forever.
So you pull out the cartridge and you blow on it and you put it back in and then it works?
I guess that's what it is, because they don't really have an animation for it. It just makes the gauge go to zero really fast.
Huh.
I think Destiny has some interesting quirks with the way it handles ammo. Like, there are
it's like, messy,
you have
but
heavy weapons,
effective.
Like rocket launchers and stuff, where there's definitely a compelling reason to not always have ammo for those guns, because they're really powerful. So it's kind of a fun bit when you find a bit of purple ammo and suddenly you can fire your rocket launcher and kill groups of enemies with ease. But at the same time, like, secondary guns like shotguns and sniper rifles also have ammo, and that sometimes feels a little like less necessary. And Year One Destiny had this really big problem where, like, because secondary weapons had ammo and you could only carry, like, you know, 20 rounds for your sniper rifle in a Halo style, like, waves of enemies game, the objectively best secondary weapon in the entire game was a gun called the Icebreaker, and it had the quirk where you didn't reload it, it just recharged ammo. And that became the gun that you used for PvE content, pretty much, like, whenever you weren't using the exotic rocket launcher that had a ridiculously high amount of damage on it. So I don't know how I feel about that. And then like, primary guns also have ammo, which you usually have, like, you know, you get an assault rifle and you have, like, 500 rounds, so you'll just never run out of it, but... Like, occasionally you do, and in those situations where you do, it really sucks.
Well, no, because it does suck, because the game is really designed for you to never run out of that. But if you actually run out of everything, if you run out of 100% of all of your ammunition in Destiny, you will automatically be refunded. I think it's like 2/3 of your primary and 2/3 of your secondary ammo, just instantly from the ether, because they know you can't play the game without any machine gun bullet.
But I have been at that spot several times, and that never happened to me, so...
It happened to me today, so I've seen it happen.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of been spent off on a tailspin of, like, trying to think of a game where reloading is inherently interesting, and it's just sort of making me think of gimmicks. Like, it's just a game where every gun had a gimmick involved with its ammo, like a gun where you can only fire it for as long as you are singing actively into the microphone, or like a gun where you can't actually fire it, or you can't actually reload it without solving a typing puzzle. So, you know, it's, you know, you got unlimited ammo, but every time you need to reload, you need to hunker down, like, under a bunker and, like, write some short phrase or something.
Oh, I can think of one. Westerado. You actually have to manually load the gun by clicking once to open the chamber and clicking R for each bullet in the you want to put in the clip, except you're usually surrounded by lots of enemies and you're not always loading it all the way, because if you want to load it all the way, you got to go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 and then close the chamber again so you can shoot it, because otherwise you will go to fire and just it'll go click and you'll die, which is hilarious and does happen a lot in that game. But what ends up happening is you end up doing the Dirty Harry thing where, like, you're never quite sure how many bullets you put in the gun, because in the middle of the gunfight, when you're loading each bullet individually, no one's going like, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, close the chamber. Okay, that's good. It's R, oh God, E, shoot, oh, I died. And it's really exciting because you don't know necessarily how many guns or how many bullets you put in the gun. And it's kind of an enjoyable little reload mechanic. I like it a lot. It's not any more deep or meaningful than active reload, but I think it gives an edge to the combat where no matter what, you have infinite ammo, but you have to actually reload, and it's the act of reloading that makes it kind of stressful. And I like that a lot.
My record is 4 buffalo saved in that game, by the way. Like, in the mini game where you have to escort the buffalo herder.
That is really hard. That part is the weirdly, like, I can clear entire towns of people, but that part is really hard.
Yeah, because it's not hard to kill them, it's hard to keep them from killing the buffalo.
Yeah. Do your bullets kill the buffalo? I can't remember. I hope they don't.
I really fucking hope they don't. Anyway.
I'm reminded of a quirk in Metro Last Light that really annoyed me in regards to ammo. And I think I've talked about this on the Diecast before, but it was a long time ago, and this was really dumb and annoyed me, so I'm going to talk about it again. Where, if you were playing on the Ranger modes in Last Light,
One of the sort of advertisements of the Ranger modes is like limited to no HUD. So you know, you don't get like that ammo counter on the HUD or anything like that, which is fine with me, but you also don't get any of the inventory management screens either. So you have this sort of weird situation where no matter what, you can never know how much ammo you have for a gun. There's no way to check unless you go to a store. Seems like something that you would be able to eyeball, you know, you look in your pack and see how many magazines you have lying around, or, you know, loose bullets or whatever. You know, and like maybe you don't get the exact number, but you'd be able to tell like the difference between I have 200 bullets and I have 2. So it created this sort of unintentional tension of, oh god, am I going to run out of ammo for this gun that I have? And you can't carry that many guns in Last Light. You can only carry 2 or 3, I don't remember, total. So, you know, running out of ammo for a gun is kind of a big deal. And they're like, and they don't all share the same ammo type either, so, you know, you can have a revolver and a shotgun and be in a level where you're picking up a whole bunch of, like, assault rifle ammo, and you're like, okay, at what point am I just gonna run out of ammo for my gun and have to go pick up some other lame gun instead? That annoyed me. That was dumb.
Well, I hope that that answers your question, even though I'm not sure we actually directly addressed the core thing you were asking about.
Yeah, I mean, it's what we do.
And in conclusion, Fallout 4 is going to be horrific.
And that's our week.
Think positive, guys.
All right, I'm positive that Fallout 4 is going to suck.
There you go.
Oh, rim shot.
Well, it's interesting to me because you guys, or at least Seamus, I know, is going to be putting hundreds of hours into this game. So whether Fallout 4 sucks or not is like a really big thing. But the way I play through Bethesda games is I sort of play about 60 hours, get through the main story, quit, and I never ever touch them again. So I'm sort of like just along for the ride, and if it sucks, it sucks. So I'm kind of in a weird position when it comes to discussing Fallout 4 sucking.
Yeah.
In this hype stage.
I mean, that's where I am.
It's like a new Star Wars movie. You have to watch it. You don't get a choice about whether you watch
it. Right.
So it has to be good. It's important.
I mean, honestly, the thing that would have to be bad for me to say that Fallout 4 is a really bad game, like, is a game that absolutely did not meet my expectations, is they have to, like, fuck up the gameplay to the point where it's, like, significantly worse than Fallout 3, and it doesn't seem like something that's going to happen. You know, I don't care if it's not Fallout and if the story is totally stupid. I mean, I kind of care on some level, but, like, it's not going to make me hate the game. Like, I'm still going to have fun just running around in the subway tunnels or, you know, the normal road tunnels in Boston, because that's how the fucking city is laid out, and it's terrible. And it's going
to
be nuts.
Okay, but like you have to care a little bit about that, right? Like, what if Vault Boy was a character you had to meet? What if he like was teamed up with Three Dog doing a radio station
somewhere?
That would be
a really trippy Fallout 4. I don't know if I'd hate that.
What if his name was Ronnie Fallout?
An animated cartoon character is running around in this otherwise like semi-serious looking 3D game, and you have to. And
you're making me want this game.
Yeah, it's...
Now Fallout 4 can't possibly live up to that.
Did we just accidentally record another 10 minutes of Diecast? Or 5 minutes of Diecast?
We wanted to end on a positive note. Seamus said, fuck it, I hate Fallout 4. Because Seamus is an old man.
I think I'm going to have fun for parts of Fallout 4. Good night, everybody!